So, step one, who can hear me? Hands up. Win. Cool. All right, step two, who's a JavaScript god? And you know what prototypical inheritance is and constructors and classes in JavaScript? No one. Excellent. So, otherwise it's just please leave now. Too smart for me. So my name's Taith Motti. I work for Redify. And what I want to go through today is sort of JavaScript for C-sharp developers. Now, if you're not a C-sharp developer, that doesn't matter. But the idea of those of us who've, we're seeing JavaScript pops up in lots of places. It's not just for the web, right? We're seeing JavaScript running on microprocessors and building Windows Store applications and phone apps and all sorts of things. So JavaScript is a first-class language, but maybe we're not so comfortable with it. We're used to classes and object-oriented inheritance and those types of concepts. So how do we adjust to that world there? Tech Ben, he should jump down to you in a sec. Make sure you're in, he'll come down. All right, so first thing I want to start with is quite simply, JavaScript is not C-sharp. That seems like a really obvious statement, but a lot of the places where I used to get in trouble with JavaScript were where I tried to beat it around and pretend like it was C-sharp and use those types of concepts. And then I'd sit there and be like, ah, this language is so annoying, it doesn't have these features. So what we're going to go through today is we're going to revisit some of the first principles to make sure that we understand all of how those things plug together. So there's a tech down the back if anyone needs help. He's kind of running around helping people. Okay, so the first major difference, which is important, is that JavaScript is a scripting language. It's not compiled. And that means that it gets interpreted in the order that it gets supplied, right? So in C-sharp, we have a whole range of files, and we can rearrange classes and methods and whatever we want in any order, and the compiler will read all of them in and link them all together. JavaScript being a scripting language, order of introduction matters. That's the first asterisk. I'll show you a case where that doesn't matter. Case sensitivity, a few little basics like that, but otherwise they're a very different language. Who's familiar with the concept of duck typing? Not so many, okay. Duck typing is the idea of if we look at something and it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it's probably a duck. So in really strict languages like C-sharp, we'll traditionally, you know, we give something a type and that's how we know what it is. In more dynamic languages, we use duck typing to recognize that, you know, if this thing has a balance and a debit and a credit method, then maybe it's an account, those types of concepts. This is how I like to understand JavaScript. So JavaScript is a little bit scary. It seems like it's a bastardization of lots of different concepts mashed together. But what we're going to walk through is understanding how our horse-headed cat that quacks like a duck is all going to work. So we'll start off with the basic concept of objects. Everything in JavaScript is an object. We'll even get to functions or objects shortly. But objects in JavaScript are very different. They're kind of more like a dictionary. Now, to walk through some of this, instead of just going slide by slide, what we're going to do is we will write a bunch of this interactively. Now, step one is I could go and write this in, you know, some HTML and wrap it in a script tag or something and run it in a browser. But to start with some of these simple concepts here, JavaScript's not just for the web. I'm actually going to run up Node on my machine, Node.js. Now, if you're not familiar with Node.js, that's okay, that's fine. But what's useful about this strategy here is I've now got what's called a REPL. So a read, execute, print loop. Right? So I can come in here and I can write some really basic JavaScript and it tells me the result straight away. So to start off with, we'll just focus on the basic code principles and then we'll start adding in things like browsers and stuff later. So I'm actually going to come in here and say var x equals that. Now x here is an empty object. Now I can actually come in and I can use this like a named array. So I can go name is Bill. And then if I go and read that out, x name, we get what we expect. But what's kind of interesting is if I go and use the property syntax and I go x.name, I also get back Bill. So our objects here are much closer to the concept of a C-sharp dictionary. It's just that some of the syntax formats, we can use them in this kind of property accessor mode. And in other cases, we can go and use them in the indexer mode. Now, it's a reasonably simple building block, but that's where we need to start. So the next concept we get to is that functions are first-class objects. So they're something that exists on their own as a top-level concept. They can just self-exist. Whereas in somewhere like C#, a function has to exist as part of a class of some form, right? Even our statics, we have to wrap them in classes. So all they are is methods that can live in a property. So if I come back across to my node console, I can come in here, and if I want to put some sort of method on my X object, I might go x.sayHello is a function and all I'm doing is assigning that function to a variable there in that scenario, right? Or assigning it to a property on that object. And if I come in now and I go x.sayHello and I invoke that, we get hello gets written out to the console. Reasonably simple. But because the function is this first class object that can get passed around and assigned to different things, if I actually go x.sayHello without the parenthesis on the end to invoke it, I can pull out that function as an object. And I could even assign that to something else. Say hi equals x.sayHello, x.sayHi. And I get that same behavior. So I can go and pass them around and put them in and out of variables and things. What's also kind of cool is that the function has properties and methods of its own because it's an object. I can actually two-string my function and I can get the code of the function back. So this is kind of like string-based reflection in JavaScript. If you get into using libraries like Angular, where they do dependency injection and they recognize it based on the parameter names, this is actually how they find it, is they just go and two-string your function definition in order to get the arguments out. So the next idea we've then got, we just sort of build up through some of these simple building blocks, and then we'll get to more complex architectures, is that the concept of this is really not what you think it is. So this is the calling context of when we invoke the function. So remember that functions are objects. They don't have a parent object that they actually belong to. Just to demonstrate that, I can come in here and I can actually just define a totally anonymous function. I can come in and give that a name. Or I could actually go var say hi equals a function. I'm not going to bother giving that any context, but I can just pass these things around. They don't belong to anything. So when we're in a function and we use this dot, what's it referring to? That can get a little bit confusing. So if I come up here, what I'm going to do is first of all define a function and put it in a variable. We'll call this, say, getPayment. And the payment here is going to take in an amount. And I want to store that in some kind of context. So I'm going to say this.cash equals that. So I'm saying this.cash, if we already had some cash, use that. If that was null, use zero. So the or else operator there is kind of like the double question mark in C#. It's a nullable coalesce in this scenario. And then I'm just going to add amount to it. I'm going to write a second function, showCash, and this is going to show me what my balance is. So this here is just going to console.log, and it says, you know, that your current cash balance is this.cash. So I've defined two functions in two different just sort of local variables there, but they both refer to the concept of this. So how's that going to work? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy those functions into that X object that I created earlier. And now I'm going to go and invoke them. And we'll have a look at what happens. I'm going to say x.getPayment 10. Now, that bit where it says undefined there is just because getPayment doesn't return anything. We'll talk about undefined shortly. But we've invoked getPayment with a value of 10. So where is the this.cash gone? If I type cash, it's not defined. This.cash, not defined. X.cash, there it is. But we said the function doesn't belong to an object, so how did it end up in X? If we scroll back up, who calls this? I can use touch on a command line to scroll. This is Windows 10, by the way. Crosses fingers that it doesn't all blow up running beta software. Where we invoked x.getPayment, brackets 10, the bit that's on the left-hand side there actually matters. because X became the calling context for that function. So we both used it to get the function from the object, and once we had it, we invoked the function in the context of X as the calling context. So then, when in that function, it said this.cache, the this was X. I'm seeing some nods. Hopefully this is starting to make more sense. What can happen differently though, is if I just go and remember I had get payment in a variable of its own, var get payment equals, and I just go and run, say, get payment 15, I didn't invoke it with a calling context there at all. So how did that work? What we also have in JavaScript is the concept of a global object, which is kind of like the default of where we start. Now, here I can then just type cache, and that's where my values ended up. Now we need to be really careful with this global object, because everything in JavaScript ends up sharing that global object. So if we get messy with our scope rules, we start stomping on other people's names, right? Somewhere in a function they used a this.cache, but then all of a sudden if some other concept uses that in my application, then we go and corrupt each other's data. Now in the browser, this global object, so we'll rerun this code in a browser and we'll see how it works differently. Before we get into actually rewriting that code, Visual Studio, I've gone File New, HTML page. There's a few things wrong with this page straight away. The first thing that's right is we have an HTML5 doc type. Good, we're running in standards mode. All of this XHTML stuff though, yeah, we tried that as a concept. That's not really that much fun. Stick to HTML5, XHTML is not a thing. And the next thing that will happen is if I come in here and type a script block, what I see a lot of people do is they then go text/JavaScript. Oops. As of HTML5, it now defaults to text/JavaScript. We decided that VBScript wasn't really a thing on the web either. So you don't have to write that anymore either. And that works in every browser going all the way back. So we can go and save that concept there. We'll just get rid of that. So then all I'm going to do here, I'll create an object and I'll do we'll do var get payment. So that's kind of like a nullable coalesce plus amount. Oops. Cache. And then I'm going to copy them onto the object. Now, we wouldn't normally copy them on, but this allows us to invoke them in the two different ways. And we'll just leave that like that for a second because we'll actually execute that from the console. Now, while we're in Visual Studio here, something that's interesting about the IntelliSense is building JavaScript IntelliSense is actually really hard. As of VS 2010, they rebuilt the IntelliSense engine, and it actually works by running this script in the background, because that's the only way you can really tell what's on an object. So when I go x.control space, like Windows plus in, we've got get payment and show cache showing up. Now, an interesting little keyword, which I've never really found a good use for in the real world, but it's cool to show, is I can actually come in here and say delete x.showCache. And I can actually delete that off an object. And now, oops, when I go x.control space, showCache doesn't exist anymore at that line. So the IntelliSense actually works different depending on where you're at in your code base. It's pretty cool. So, and that's using the Chakra JavaScript engine, which is the same JavaScript engine that runs in IE. So anyway, we'll get rid of that. I'm going to go across, load this up in a browser. And if I look at X as an object, we've got that available in the console. So this console across the bottom here is just the F12 console in the browser. Now, if I go x.getPayment 10, oops, or 1, that'll do, and I run X again, we can see that cache has shown up on X. Cool. The functions that we haven't sort of put them in any scope though, so where we've just declared those vars, we've got get payment exists at the root. if I go get payment 15 for a different value, where that cache bit's gone, the global object in the browser here is on the window object. So it's on window.cache. But everything's on the window object. It's a really messy place to put anything. Because if I go window and we have a look at what's in here, whoops, make my screen bigger to actually fit it. We've got index.db, we've got status bar, we've got speech, we've got scroll stuff, we've got frames, cryptography, you know, like everything. This is all the capabilities of the browser live on this window object. So that's just the root namespace. So we need to be really careful when we're writing applications not to go and dirty up that top level object. And the calling context matters with that. Okay, so to clean this up, we now need to introduce the concept of a closure. So closures are the idea of a function that can basically access their parent, right? So they can access the variables enclosed by their parent. That becomes an interesting concept. So this one here, we'll write this in Visual Studio rather than over in the REPL, just so that we can replay some scenarios as we go easily. So what I'm gonna do here is just create an object, var z, and I'm using an object literal syntax here where I've got just the braces, and then I can initialize this kind of like a dictionary. So I go I colon zero, right? The equivalent way to write that would be I could say var z equals an empty object, z dot I equals zero, whoops, if I want to go and do that. Or I can actually initialize that with square brackets, but we'll look at array versus object semantics shortly. Or I can even say new object, or object create, or all sorts of ways. But we're going to use this syntax. So I'm going to do I colon zero, and then I'm going to put a function on this. I'm just going to call it fn, function keyword. A is going to be another function. We're going to invoke A, and then we're going to console.log this.i. And then down here, I'm going to call function. So, what on earth is going on in this code? First of all, we've got a closure. The concept of how this bit here can refer out to I, and I's up here, is a closure. The function's accessing something that exists on its parent, right? Or an even simpler example of a closure would be if I went var b equals foo, oops, and I used b down here, that's a closure, right? I'm accessing something from a parent scope. But if we walk through this, this block of code here is going to execute in terms of initializing some states, setting up some objects. It's not really going to actually run any of that though. We get down to the next line and we're running function, and Z is the calling context. So we're going to run this, which means that as we're coming through this block of code here, any references to this is Z. What's the bet on zero as what's going to end up in the log? What's the bet on 42? And the other two-thirds of the room have a different answer? Okay, let's run this and see what happens. We got zero. How did that happen? Walk through this right down to the last level. So as we come in here, our calling context is Z. This bit here, just save something into memory, done, we move on. And then we execute A. There's nothing on the left-hand side of that invocation. So the calling context for A is the default scope. So when we run that, this is not Z. If we come out to the browser, and we look at window.i, it's gone and put that in the global window object. So because we got our calling context wrong, we've dirtied up the global window object. Now, you think about little micro little variables like this where it's just throw around little bits of state, and you think about getting this wrong in two different bits of code, and you're building a complex web application or a Windows Store app or something like that, this is where we get gremlins in the code base and everything starts working in pretty funky ways. So we have a couple of options here. We could try to change this to a method syntax. Now, if we want Z to be the calling context, I could try to go this.a, so that's on the left-hand side. But when I run that, we get an error because A is not a property on this. So I could copy it in there just for the sake of running it or something, but that gets a bit awkward. So a common pattern that we use, and there's nothing special about this in a keyword sort of sense, is the concept of that. So we go var that equals this. So whenever we want to capture the calling context and work with that reliably, rather than sort of guessing what it is and passing it all the way down, we use closures and the ability to access the parent context, and we refer to that as some other variable. So I'm going to use that. And this way in our development, one time entering the function or some sort of scope, we explicitly say, I care about the calling context and I know what it is, so I'm going to capture that into a variable, and then everywhere else we just refer to that. So now when I run this, I get 42. And if I look at window.i, it's not there. If I look at z.i, it's 42. So we now get the behavior that we expect. So there's nothing special there in terms of a language construct or a keyword or anything like that. The concept of var that is just a nice, useful convention. Gets really complex to talk about. This is that, and that's, no, it's not that, it's that. No, no, it's this. But it works. The other concept that we have is, particularly in libraries, the calling context is a really useful way of passing state around, and we might want to be really explicit about what that actually is. So an example of that kind of approach would be if we were using, before I get into this, how many people are familiar with jQuery? Lots of people, sweet. jQuery is not JavaScript. Anyone that says, yeah, I know JavaScript, I write lots of jQuery. No, you know jQuery. jQuery hides so many of these concepts, but it's built on a lot of those basic JavaScript concepts. If we went in here and did something like, you know, button dot, and then we subscribe to an on click, and then we supply a callback, the way that we work out which button got clicked is this. They pass in the button object as the calling context, right? So how do they do that? They're explicitly invoking that function with a specific context. Now we can do that up here. So remember how I showed you that functions are objects and they have their own properties and methods? Like we took a function and we went dot toString. There's other stuff we can do on that as well. So instead of invoking A directly, if I go dot, we'll see there's all this stuff that comes off the actual function. ToString's one of them, but there's dot call. So I can say I want to call that function and I can explicitly pass in a calling context. So rather than just going A bracket bracket magically invokes and the runtime picks the calling context for us, we can actually invoke that with specific scenarios. I can also come in here and invoke it with, I can pass in an array of arguments and all sorts of stuff. So it's actually quite a dynamic language with what in C# we would have to do reflection concepts to do. Here, that's a first class concept that lives on the function object. So if I can actually, I'll make that this, I'll get rid of this. So I'm not using the that concept there at all. I'm just doing a.call this. I refresh this, we got 42. Window.i, not there. Z.i is there and it's 42. So that's the call method off the back of a function. Good? Cool. If we just take a brief look at what else is on a function, I guess. Apply, bind, and call are all similar sort of concepts. They have slightly different semantics, but they're all different ways of invoking a function and passing in different contexts. A function itself, we'll get to what prototypes are. ToString is useful in that it just returns the body of that function for you. Some functions you'll find, if we look at some of the built-in functions and we try to go toString on them, you just get native code. So that's where the browser, it doesn't actually run that function in JavaScript, it runs it in C or whatever under the covers. But otherwise, you can two-string around. Okay, so this is just that closure concept. Because that wasn't using the method syntax, we had the global object instead. All these slides are going to be available on Yammer, if not already. So if you join the Yammer group through the techedmelbourne.hub.me, you can download all this code. And any of these codes that aren't on the slides is in the notes. So we did the that concept. All right, so functions can optionally have a name. If it doesn't have a name, it's just an anonymous function. So if I'm in here, I can go function foo, and I've put a name in the start there, and then foo is a thing. Or if I don't give it a name, that's an anonymous function. So then I need to do something with that for it to be useful. So I can go and assign it to a variable, or because it's a first class concept as an object, I can just do something with it straight away. So we have the idea of we can sometimes immediately invoke functions. If I wrap that in brackets, it's now sort of something I'm just using in my current state, and then I can invoke it straight away. Console.log hi, just to prove it's running. So that says hi. So I've taken a function, wrapped it in brackets, and then invoked it straight away. So that's a way that we can create scope boundaries without sort of bleeding everything out to the global window object. If we go back and look at what we're doing here, we did a reasonable job of we've encapsulated our state, z.i, into the z object, and we haven't bled that out, but we still bled out the concept of z. We went and smashed that onto the global object, and that has the possibility to conflict with things. So if that's just something where, I don't know, maybe it's going to subscribe to an event, maybe this is some jQuery code that's just going to go and listen to something, but we want to hold some state and share things. To put that in its own little boundary, we can wrap that in a function, and then we can wrap that in brackets, and then we can invoke it straight away. And now, when I load this page, 42 comes out on the console because my code has run, but I go window.z, it's not there. I'm not leaking any of my internal details onto the global state of the application. So sometimes you'll see this approach referred to as an IIFE, immediately invoked function expression, okay? Where you might see a slightly different rendition of this is in jQuery. Instead of wrapping it and then invoking it, you'll see this is a common jQuery structure where they do dollar function. So that's encouraging you to put the scope boundary there, but jQuery defers the execution of it until later in the page lifecycle when you've got document ready. But that's part of the reason they encourage you to do that. It's not just about lifecycle, it's about scoping as well. I generally prefer not to do that, because if your JavaScript's dependent on the page load lifecycle in a web scenario, then you put it in the wrong place in the HTML. But that's another talk. So functions can optionally have a name. They can return a value. That's fairly basic. But they can also return themselves. So some of what you can see is what I could potentially do here is say return this.fn. So when I call fn, it returns fn. Now, why would I want to do that? I can use that to build chains. So here, where I'm invoking it, I can just do that. And I'm now invoking that six times, without having to write the line six times or do something like that. Now, I might pass different arguments in, but I can build those types of chains and pipelines by just returning the same function over and over again. Actually, before we get too far, just while I think of it, on the topic of names, the concept of how jQuery uses that dollar bit there, dollar is just a valid name for a function. There's lots of crazy things that are valid names. So a bunch of the libraries, they just go and attach to that concept. Another library that I use quite often is a thing called underscore.js. It's just underscore.js. which is really good for processing kind of functional pipelines of data. It's kind of like link in JavaScript. And theirs is just, you sort of go underscore my data dot, and then you can do a map and a select and a reduce and all those types of concepts there. They just use underscore. That's just a function name is all it is. Oops. Okay, a function can optionally have parameters, same as what we used to, but they always have this implicit concept of an arguments parameter. So whilst we have named parameters, we don't have to access them via their names. I'm going to get rid of a bunch of this code. Let's just do this. So I can do function foo bar baz as arguments. I'm going to put the debugger keyword in there. So rather than writing out some kind of console.log or whatever, that's just like a forced break. I don't have to go and find it and put a breakpoint on it. It'll just automatically tell the debugger to stop. And then I'm going to come in here and I'm going to do foo abc def ghi. That's not a typo. I've supplied three parameters or three arguments to a function that only takes two parameters. I run this in the browser. Because I had the debugger call there, it's automatically jumped in, broken on that line for me. So that can be nicer rather than having to go and, you know, find the debugger breakpoint. And in my locals over here, in the local scope, I've got bar and baz are initialized as local scope variables, so that's easy to access. But if I jump across to just console, I've got an array of arguments waiting for me there. So I can just come in and say, you know, give me the third argument. Oops, sorry, give me the, I swear I can count. Give me the third argument. Does everyone know that there's three types of problems in computing, naming things, off by one arguments? So I can go and access them in that way. Now, something that's important to note here is that when parameters come through, they don't come through in a named way at all in terms of the actual invocation, right? So this arguments bit here is just an array of the values. There are no keys. So these names here, all that's happening is when you get to the execution of your function, it's just going, oh, they want bar to be automatically initialized as a variable based on argument zero. That's all it's doing. It's not actually in the data that gets passed across. I can also go and invoke this with just one argument. And when I reload this, I look at console. Oops. Arguments, we get that. But if I look in sources that we're broken on, because we asked for baz to be initialized as a variable, but there is no second one, it gets initialized as undefined. So that comes through. So what's interesting is this last little statement here. Functions cannot be overloaded. Most of my statements here have some form of exception or asterisk against them, but this one has a really big asterisk against it. In C sharp, we can go and create overloads. So that's where we have two or more methods that all have exactly the same name, and they get invoked based on the signature, right? In JavaScript, we can't do that. You have one function that uses that name or that reference because it's an object, and you invoke it. So we can't have multiple sharing the name, but we do get that with different libraries, right? So we see that with, if we use jQuery as another example, I can do button.click, and that clicks the button, or I can use an overload where I supply a callback, and that subscribes to the onClick event, and we get it coming invoked when the button gets clicked. It's not clicking it, right? So all that they're doing there in their click function is they're going, if arguments.length equals zero, do this. If arguments.length equals one, do this. That's how overloads get implemented in JavaScript. One function can change its behavior dynamically based on the arguments coming into it. Cool. Functions have a calling context exposed as this. Hopefully everyone's happy with that concept now. That's kind of the big brain explode moment that I had where JavaScript started to become comfortable. So something else what you saw get introduced there was null. We had the concept of undefined. So we're moving on from functions now, by the way. We can only talk about functions to death for at least 20 minutes. So null and undefined are two different concepts. They're both primitive types, which is important because we'll get to primitives in a second and inequality. They both evaluate to false in Boolean expressions. So if we're going something equals undefined or null, then it's false. Null is for the absence of a value. So we know that that person does not have a password assigned, or you know, they don't have this thing. Undefined is we're like, I don't know. Cats. It's the Schrodinger scenario. We don't know what that is. It might have a value, it might not. It just doesn't exist. So that's where we saw, that's important, where we have things like Baz coming through here as undefined, we know that that argument was not supplied, as opposed to it could have been supplied, but null. Two distinctly different concepts. So from a runtime perspective, they're both primitives, they both evaluate to false in Boolean expressions, nobody really cares, they're pretty much the same thing at the runtime level, asterisk, I could get in trouble for saying that, but pretty much. It's largely in your own code semantics to use the right one. Is it undefined or is it null? The same as we need to think about, is it zero or is it null? But then we get into equality. So just before there, I typed arguments and I used three equal signs. Now I did that on purpose. That wasn't a typo either. So in JavaScript, we have the concept of truthy and falsy. If we just look at the rules here, we'll talk about the prefer in a second. Objects are only equal to themselves, so it's referential equality. Even if you create two objects with all the same properties, they're not the same thing. It's only if you sort of pass that object around and then compare it back to itself. Primitives are equal if the square peg kind of looks round. If JavaScript can take that square peg and bash it into a round hole, it goes, yeah, sure, they're the same thing. So if we just go back to our console over here, I can go 0 equals 0, two equal signs, true. It's what we expect. I can also say that 0 equals the string of 0, true, correct. This is where we start to get fun data validation issues. 0 equals false, true, correct. Apparently 0 equals anything, right? I can go null equals 1. Now I start to get a false. That's where null evaluates to false in Boolean expressions. So this is a concept of truthy. It's kind of true, looks sort of the same-ish. In contrast, if we use the triple equals, that's the same thing. This is not. We get a false that comes out. So that there is, it's not using type coercion. When you only use two equal signs, it'll do type coercion. It'll say, that's a string, that's a number. I can kind of make these the same thing. Let's go. When we use the triple equals, it doesn't do that. So by default, you should be using triple equals. It's a stricter equality comparison. A lot of cases with equality, I'll find bugs that relate to people using a very loose equality comparison, particularly in validation code and things like that. They're like, is this empty? And it's like, well, it's not empty. It just had a zero in it that the user typed. But sure, now they're equal. So yeah, it's empty. So there's a validation rule. You can also do, there's a not double equals. So your three length operator versus your two length operator. So by default, I would encourage you to use the stricter comparison without type coercion. There are valid cases to use type coercion. Opt into them rather than opting out of them. So explicitly choose to do that. Okay, so classes in JavaScript. Classes are a useful concept. We use them for things like inheritance. We use them to provide a nice API surface to some behavior. We want to be able to create an instance of something. We want to be able to invoke methods, have it hold state, all those kinds of basic concepts that we're used to in C#. There is no class keyword in JavaScript. Another asterisk, there is. It's in ECMAScript 6, which is the next version of JavaScript. Let's just wait until that runs on every device imaginable. It's worth being aware of though, because where we're looking at things like developing, say Windows Store applications in JavaScript and running stuff on microprocessors and things like that, a lot of them run a particular version of JavaScript. So if you're targeting a single platform and not something as broad as web browsers, you might be able to use some of the newer concepts. So there is a class keyword coming there. But the intention of the class keyword in C# is not to change any of the underlying imperative machinery. It's just to give a nice declarative way for setting up the sort of the semantics that the developer's expecting. There's in the notes on the slides, if you get them, there's a link that explains their reasoning. So there's no class keyword, but there is a new keyword. So we can create a new instance of something. So how does that work? Well, we've got constructors. Let's have a look at them. So what I'm gonna do here is I'm gonna create a function for Apple. Now, mostly the convention that we use in JavaScript is that it's camel casing, right? So it's like say hello, the hump's in the middle, lowercase s at the start. However, I'm gonna type this one as Apple with a capital A. The convention is that if you're putting a capital in the front, and this is just a convention, it's not enforced at all, but if there's a capital on the front, then it's a constructor function. So somebody can expect to invoke a new keyword on it. Now what I'm gonna take here is I'm gonna take in a type attribute for the type of apple that we have, and I'm gonna store that in some context. It's a red apple, and we'll just start with that. So this concept there, you know, what's the calling context gonna be? If I come across to the browser, I'm gonna reload this console, I'm gonna say new apple tasty. And that returned an object. And the left-hand bit, we didn't get that before when we had objects coming out. It didn't have a type or something, but now it's got kind of a type of apple, and then it's got some state that's in that object. Or I could even go and assign that to a variable. I can go var A equals a tasty apple, var B equals a rotten apple. And now I can pull out A is a tasty red apple, and B is a rotten red apple, right? So I can start to create instances of things. So just that convention of the new keyword, invoking a function, and all of a sudden we're starting to get constructors and objects. So what that's doing there, the new keyword creates, in this case, an empty object, and then it takes that object and it invokes it as the calling context on the constructor function. So me saying new apple tasty is the equivalent, if I went like var A equals, the longer version of me writing that would be var A is an object, and then I want to go apple.call A, and I want to pass in an array of arguments, which is tasty, and that's now my context. So it's just syntactic sugar on top of that, right? Calling context initializes an empty object for you. And all of a sudden, voila, we have types. How nice. So I want to start to add some behavior to this though. I don't want to have to, I want to be able to format out the name of the apple, right? So I'm just going to create a function here, function get apple info, which is going to be return this.color plus this.type plus apple. So red tasty apple. And I'm going to say this.get apple info equals that function. So I'm going to copy it onto the object. Whoops. And then var A equals new apple tasty console.log A dot. This is showing up in IntelliSense. So you can see how the IntelliSense has to be pretty smart to work all this out. Get apple info. Whoops. And I need to invoke that. So if I go over and run this, I get red tasty apple comes out. Easy enough. We've got some problems here though. First of all, get apple info, because we declared that at the top level, is leaked out onto our window object. So we want to clean that up. So what I'm going to do is, rather than defining it outside here, I can move this in and I can just declare it in line. Simple enough. Now, what's interesting here is, remember with our calling context and our closures, when I say this.color in that function, that only works not because it's inside this constructor. This bit of code only works because I'm calling it as a.getAppleInfo. It's the method syntax down the bottom that makes that work. So that's one step ahead, because I can go across here, and I run this, I get my text written out, but getAppleInfo, it's not auto-completing, it's not on the global object. However, now what I'm doing is every time I create an apple, I'm initializing another copy of that function in memory. So if I have 5,000 data rows, I have 5,000 copies of that function. Not very efficient. And going and inheriting off that or something like that starts to become difficult. So this is where we get the concept of a prototype. So I'm going to pick up this code. Off our function, one of the concepts we have here is there's a property called prototype. I'm going to do this. I'm going to put that function on the prototype for Apple. Now what happens is that's kind of like, almost like a base class, or it's the definition, it's the blueprint for how to create one of these objects. So if I go and run this, reload it, we're seeing get tasty apple written out. Or if I just come in here and go new apple rotten, we see that coming up as a type apple and the function's available there, but that actually only exists once on that prototype definition. So that's, we've now got the concept of something equivalent to a class where we've got a nice sort of method signature on top of it. We're holding some form of state, we have a constructor, and we can go new apple, and we have nice object type oriented sort of code, right? So we've done that. No, I won't show that. So what's actually happening here is that now, when we're doing that new keyword, rather than it starting from an empty object, what it's doing is it's creating a copy of the prototype, sort of just referential pointers, and then going and then executing the constructor against that. Now we can actually use this to do inheritance as well. Now rather than just imagine this code works, it does, I tested it. I can set up var food is a function, and I can store some sort of sugar value on that in state. And then on the food prototype, I can go and put like an is healthy function on it, right? Then I can go and create fruit is a function. Now, what in order to invoke kind of where fruit wants to inherit from food, in order to invoke the base constructor, there I'm actually doing food.call and passing in the context of this. So, hey, please go and run the base constructor and pre-initialize that with, you know, 10 units of sugar or something, right? And then what I can do here is I can say fruit.prototype equals object.create food.prototype. So I'm actually copying the food prototype onto the fruit prototype. And then I actually need to copy the constructor back on. And then I can go var apple equals new fruit. And this now has an is healthy method. It calls this constructor, all of that. Works pretty well. This bit here is interesting though, where I had to copy the constructor back on though. Now the reason for this is that, and I'll show this in this console. If we change the prototype at all, that changes in the future as well. So I'm going to come in here and I'm going to say var x equals new array, or actually I'll use a shorter syntax of this, x equals 1, 2, 3 in an array. And on here, there is a for each method where I can say console.log this times 2. So off an array, I'm invoking the for each function and I'm passing in another function as the callback, and the this as the calling context of the function is going to be whatever element in the array that we're on, right? So I should see, not a number, that's nice. X, yeah, that should work. That's a whole lot. I already initialized X earlier as something else. I'm going to do this not in node. So Z here, actually, I'll do this as, sorry, just to be explicit. Right, now in this case here, Z has a for each method, and we'll do that console.log. Actually, no, I'm just getting my, we've been so fixated on calling contexts, it does actually pass it into this one. Right, so I get 1, 2, 3 comes out. It actually gets passed in as an argument. So what I can actually do here is I can now go in array.prototype dot, and there's the definition of for each. But I can go and replace this with a function and just go computer says no. And now even though I'm not gonna reinitialize Z at all, I try to go Z.forEach and it just goes, no, not gonna do that. So I can actually change the base behavior of an array, even on arrays that I've already created, by changing the prototype of the array or any other object, right? Now, this also becomes useful in the concept of polyfills. So polyfills is anywhere we're working in an environment that doesn't support a feature, rather than sort of saying, so for each is relatively new, like IE6 doesn't support it. So rather than saying, okay, we don't use for each in our application because only newer browsers support it, what we can actually do is we can test, is for each defined? So we can actually have code sort of at the start of our application loading where we go if array.prototype.forEach is undefined, then we could go and put our own implementation on it. We add it to the prototype and then we can write nice new good code afterwards, right? And when we don't need to support that polyfill anymore, we rip it out. So we can actually change base concepts in JavaScript relatively easily. So that's inheritance and prototype. Okay, back on the window object briefly. The window object's the global namespace for the browser. Anything defined outside a function and not defined with var ends up on window. So the not defined with var bit is if we're writing a function and, I don't know, I just do it here. And I just go, ABC equals boo, even though that's in a function block there, it's going to end up on the global window object. So easy to mess that thing up. So you need to use var if it's a local scope. Some people try to say, oh, you don't have to do that, it's redundant. No, it actually works differently. And this is if you go and run tools like JSHint or JSLint, they'll pick that up as a warning and tell you, please write better code. If you explicitly want to put it on the window object, do window.abc. The other thing that I see a common misconception is people think that source files have some form of scoping boundary. Oh, but that's loaded in file abc.js and that's loaded from file def.js. Completely irrelevant, absolutely no difference at all. It's not a compiled language, it's a scripting language. So all it does is just read in JavaScript in whatever order it comes into the engine and off we go and it executes. That's all it cares about. No scoping boundary whatsoever. The little asterisk to that though is in terms of the whatever order it comes in at and being a scripting language, before we wrote this, and it worked. So the function was referring to get Apple info before we'd defined that. Now, when we get to this line of code here, yeah, that needs to go and set up some, initialize something in memory, but it's not actually executing the function. It's not doing anything at that point, right? So there's another thing called function hoisting, where as it reads a JavaScript file in, the first thing it does is it sees all these definitions and it goes, no, Tatham doesn't want that. And it goes bang. And the interpreter actually moves the code before it then goes and interprets it. So that's how that semantic sometimes comes out a bit weird, if it's kind of a scripting language, but not quite. JavaScript does funky things. So one of the final concepts I want to talk about quickly is namespaces to avoid collisions. So we've seen inheritance, we've seen constructors, we've seen state. The last little bit we don't really have is namespaces, but they're very easy to create because classes are really just functions that happen to be constructors, and functions are just objects, and objects can just live in other objects. So what we can do here is we can do window.fruitshop, and we can just make that an empty object using that literal syntax. And then here, instead of going function apple, I can go fruitshop.apple equals function. And I can use that different syntax of just swapping the name across. So now I'm assigning it to that. I can do fruitshop.apple.prototype. And then down here, I can go new fruitshop.apple. And all of a sudden, I've just gone and namespaced my JavaScript using an object, right? Pretty simple to do. So if we took that sort of concept and then we wrapped that in an immediately executing function boundary, and that was what lived in our file, all of a sudden we're creating a class with a defined API surface that we're consciously publishing out what we want onto the global window object in a namespace. That's pretty clean coding, right? And it's all possible in JavaScript. Clicker. Okay, two last bits. Arrays, modular JavaScript, and I've got the 5-minute sign, so we're gonna go quick. So arrays are not what you're used to from C#. They're in the same way that objects are kind of like dictionaries, and arrays are objects, and everything's an object, even functions are objects. Arrays are more like a dictionary of int object. So it's got an auto-incremented key as a number, and then the .length property just returns that value. So what does this mean? I'm gonna come in here, oops, get a nice clean session. Actually, I might just reinitialize that. Okay, so I'm gonna say var a equals 1, 2, 3. So that there is actually also the equivalent of me saying new array as an object type. It's just syntactic sugar. And I'll set up var b as another one of just some text values in it. Okay, now if I go for var I equals 0 and I want to, oops. That's less than length, and I'll increment it, and we're just going to say console.log AI. That does exactly what we expect. We get 1, 2, 3, right? Now the newer way I can do this is I can go, I'll do it as a dot for each. And we get that coming out as well. Now, something that a lot of people see when they're in Visual Studio or somewhere is they come in here and they're typing some JavaScript and they go for, and there's this for in snippet. So why would I use for each as this kind of callback type thing, or write a manual for loop if there's this for in snippet? What does it do? For var I in O. Well, that looks really nice. Why don't we go and run that? For var I in A, console.log I. Those numbers are different. Why are they different? Those are actually the indexes, or they're actually the names of things that are in this object. Because I could, on A, I could also just go and add something else, like hi tech ed. And now when I run that, I get hi comes out, right? But it's still an array because I have a.length is 3. If I come in and I went a.push foo, a.length is 4, and it's introduced 3 as the property type. So all it's doing is it looks for this auto-generated key value and generates the next highest number, and then dot length returns that. So the last little concept that gives us is the concept of sparse arrays. If I go var aa equals an empty array, and I go aa5 equals foo, a dot length equals 6. So if I did a, because I've initialized the sixth element, so it automatically says the length is 6. If I then went a dot, like if I did 4 to length and I read out, you know, naught through, I wanted aa dot length. There we go, aa dot length. If I went aa 0, it's undefined there. But if I did the 4 I in AA, console.log, I, it only returns the dense component of the array. So for I, while less than I than a.length, can be a completely different result to for in. For in is enumerating all of the properties on that object, where the array happens to be an object with property names that are auto-incremented numbers. Hopefully that'll just click together. So to wrap up there, we've gone through some fairly basic sort of concepts, and it might have been a little bit slow, but hopefully interesting. What I wanted to get across is that JavaScript is a complete language. I know when I first started working with JavaScript back when we had to start using it on the web in the DHTML days, I was like, oh, this thing's shocking. I really don't like writing this. It's such a simple, basic language. It is actually a fully featured language. And now that we're starting to develop real applications in it, and we're building, you know, Windows Store apps, and you can write Cordova apps and run them on, like build iPhone apps in JavaScript and all sorts of stuff. We need to start to actually understand that all these principles are there and that we can actually build high quality applications. So you can still write clean code and don't be afraid of it. So thanks for coming along. The slides will be up on Yammer. Cheers.